Hello, and welcome to the TV Movie Rewind Podcast with Matt and Todd.
Hi, everyone.
Todd, this is our 150th episode.
Mm-hmm.
As we record this on Sunday, March 17th, it is one of our favorite actors, Kurt Russell's birthday.
Happy birthday, Kurt.
And it is also St. Patrick's Day.
That's right.
So we actually managed to come across the perfect movie to celebrate all three of those things.
Including St. Patrick's Day.
Including St. Patrick's Day.
Go on.
So, well, let's
well, we should probably at least mention the movie.
Well, it's in the title. People know by when they're clicking on. But yes, we're doing 1998's Soldier. Now, we've got, of course, Kurt Russell. We actually wanted to do this movie a little a few weeks ago, but we had some difficulty, so we had to postpone it till now. So it was kind of kismet that it came up now on our 150th, because if you add those individual digits of 150 together, 1 + 5 + 0 = 6. This is our 6th Kurt Russell movie.
Oh, right on.
After we've done, you know, Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China, The Thing, Tombstone, and Tango and Cash. As we mentioned, this is Kurt Russell's birthday. And one of the, well, also there's a song in the middle of the movie done by Lorena McKennitt, which is a very Celtic style song. So that ties into St. Patrick's Day. And one of the plot points of the movie is battling snakes, much like the famed St. Patrick did in Ireland.
Okay.
And I just threw out my shoulder reaching for that one.
Yeah. 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 You're reaching, but hey, it, you know, it works. I'll take it.
But we're doing it.
Yeah.
This movie seems older than it is, because it does seem very much of an 80s movie. And that's part of that is because it was written in 1983.
Oh, wow.
By the screenwriter, David Webb Peoples, who wrote the script for Blade Runner, as well as numerous other films, at least whether he wrote them individually or co-wrote them. He also did other movies we covered, like Lady Hawk and Leviathan, which we covered fairly recently.
Yeah, that was just two episodes ago.
12 Monkeys and Unforgiven, you know, other big movies. But he wrote this movie as a, his word, sidequel to Blade Runner. He wanted this movie to take place in the Blade Runner universe.
Oh, wow.
And one of the, you know, kind of holdovers is, and there is so many science fiction movie Easter eggs buried in this film. There's a couple I've spotted, and then there's other people. You go online and you check all like the trivia and stuff, and you see dozens more that I've never been able to spot myself. But
I didn't even know. I mean, aside from the Kurt Russell reference, the other Kurt Russell movie references, I didn't know there would be that many. I guess I'm not surprised, but that's really cool.
Well, you see one of the Blade Runner ships. Well, not a ship, but one of those flying pod cars that you see in Blade Runner. You see one of those in the junk pile towards the end of the movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And somebody has said that one of the weapons Kurt Russell uses is abbreviated P39QSM for the famous Marvin the Martian's PQ-39 space modulator.
Right on.
If you look at, they say if you look, if you look closely at some of the star maps and charts that come up, you see references to other movies. And I guess the biggest reference is the bioengineered soldiers that, you know, basically replace the line of soldiers Kurt Russell was a part of, are the replicants that, you know, Blade Runners hunt down when they go rogue.
Oh, okay.
So
is that, I guess, is that, I suppose that's the clue as to how this was intended to fit in the Blade Runner universe. Like it's almost the origin of the.
And also, like, the movie, even though the movie came out in 98, it starts in 1996. And I guess he did that to time it for that when these genetically engineered soldiers debut. If you follow the timeline as the movie goes along, it coincides with when the first replicants are said to have been made in Blade Runner.
Okay.
So
I had no idea it all went that deep. I mean, I just always took it for granted as a badass Kurt Russell movie.
Well, you know, I don't. When I first got the DVD and, you know, I watched the movie and then I, you know, listened to the commentary and, you know, watched it over, and they make a lot of reference to it being a sidequel to Blade Runner, that, you know, it wasn't until they started making references themselves that I was like, oh yeah, look at that. Oh yeah, that does line up.
Yeah. You know? I mean, the only thing I think I ever picked up on was the, what is it? The Pliskin patch. And the MacReady medal or something.
And then I guess there's even references. There's other medals and awards that reference Stargate and Captain Ron.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Other movies as well.
Oh, that's cool. So it's a movie that you could spend a lot of time pausing. Like you could take all day to watch this movie if you're trying to pick all that stuff up.
Yeah. Yeah. But this movie, it's almost like the universe was against it being made. Because it took 15 years after the script was written to be made into a movie. Kurt Russell injures himself in the first week of shooting, but they were able to schedule and shoot around his injury. Like, well, we'll just shoot. He's got a broken ankle, so all the scenes where he's lying in bed, we'll film now. Okay, now all the scenes where he's sitting up and sitting, we'll film those. And now we'll film the scenes where he's just standing and not having to move around. So they kind of had to accommodate for his injury. Also, they really wanted to make this movie look like it was in a huge open world with these big sweeping vistas. But by the time they got ready to film, we're nearing production, El Nino had kind of spoiled their weather and they weren't able to shoot outside. So this was almost all shot on interior sets.
Oh, okay. So a lot of green screen.
I don't know if it was so much green. I mean, I'm sure there was green screen, but you know, they have these huge, you know, giant indoor sets that, you know, they can film a lot of. So it seems like they're outside because it's so huge. And a lot of the imagery on that planet is windswept and there's dust being blown around, so I'm sure that helped hide a lot of it as well. But they wanted it to look like, because this movie is kind of modeled after numerous westerns. The one, sure, I see most dropped is Shane, you know, the famed gunfighter that has hung up his guns and wants to move back to his small hometown and settle down. I mean, that he hasn't hung up his guns. Granted, this is against his choices that he is where he is. But it
he's literally thrown into the trash.
It follows that same theme.
Yeah.
Now, this movie, you know, kicks off right away. You get, you know, again, it's now. The movie now begins nearly 30 years in our past from when we're recording this.
Right.
But again, you know, it's an alternate future. And I'm sure when he was writing the script in 1983, 1996 seemed enough in the future that this could have come to pass. But, you know, we're shown a society where babies, right from the day they're born, are selected to be in the military. What exactly they look for, or whether, you know, maybe they're orphans, or however they're selected, they're selected. And immediately, you know, we see them at age, you know, these kids at age 5 being forced to watch horrible brutality as dogs and boars fight to the death in front of them.
Right. It's all about desensitizing.
Desensitizing to violence, obey orders, physical fitness, mental fitness, because we also see them putting together, you know, puzzles and arranging shapes. you know, that and right from the beginning, our hero, who will be Sergeant Todd, played by Kurt Russell, is excelling at all of them.
Perhaps.
At age 11, we get a cameo by Kurt Russell's son, Wyatt, playing Sergeant Todd, leading a, you know, a cadet, what's the word I'm looking for? Not jog. I mean, they're jogging, but he's leading the cadets on a run, holding a flag. And unfortunately, one of the cadets is straggling behind. And the response is they shoot that kid.
They just shoot him.
Just shoot him. And, you know, like, they couldn't have found a desk job or something, you know?
Right. Like, you spent all that time, effort, and money to even get them that far. You'd think you would have found something in, like, you know, the propaganda department or something.
And unfortunately, if you think about it, he's had all the same training and physical preparedness as the others. So there must be something in him, like whether he just maybe has asthma or,
right,
you know, there must be something physically, you know, holding the kid back, you know, because it wouldn't be like he was any different from the other boys.
Well, right. Well, plus you got to figure that the hardest part of this whole exercise in order to get what you're looking for, you know, obviously it's the physical fitness and the combat ability and all that, but that's one thing, but also just like the mental aspect, which you'd think that, you know, that would have had some sort of investment value to stick with and to just, you know, that reason alone to find something to do with them rather than just kill them because it couldn't, you know, he couldn't run fast enough. You'd think the mindset that you've been able to germinate in there, I assume, any, like, you know, we don't know the backstory. We just see the kid lagging behind and then he gets shot. Like, you know, maybe he was the class clown or something. I have no idea. Maybe that was the last straw, but it does seem, yeah, it seems pretty extreme. And it's like, you know, you could have used him because he's at least got the mindset you're looking for. And I would think that's the hardest thing to get.
Yeah, it may also just be a message to the others that if you're not
Sure.
You know, if you're not top, you're not existent at all.
Right. Or at the very least, it's a way to just, you know, really drill home that, like, yeah, if you're not ahead of the game, if you're not the best, this is what happens to you. You know, like, now it's us doing it, but if this was like in an actual combat, you know, you'd just be killed. You know, the enemy would kill you because you're too slow or whatever.
It's survival of the fittest, right. And only the fittest survive.
Right. Would you say they're more extreme? I would say so than Starship Troopers.
Definitely more extreme than Starship Troopers because at least still in Starship Troopers, it's something you sign up for.
Exactly. It's volunteer, yeah.
I mean, this kind of goes with, like, you know, some of the Spartan legends, you know, of the Spartans and stuff like that. But it's pretty extreme. But you do see in an opening montage, in a fantastic opening montage.
Oh, it's great.
That, you know, you the results are there.
Right.
Because we get to see Sergeant Todd and some of his men participating in combat.
Yeah.
The War of the Six Cities, the Moscow incident, which seems to be much more than an incident.
Right. I want to see these movies, by the way.
Well, that's the thing is you.
I really do.
They perfectly give you a glimpse of these, and the way they transition from one battle into another is amazing. Because the first one, you know, you're seeing some city warfare, and then it cuts to, you know, a frozen over snowy Moscow, and then they're in pressure suits, you know, space suits, fighting on these moons, blasting each other away with these guns. And it leaves you wanting more, but it is enough.
Yeah,
it's not like you don't feel cheated by it, but you do wish, like, you could see more of that.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's like, yeah, that's the takeaway of those scenes. Like, it does a great job of world building in a very short amount of time. To really set you up where this is going, but also it's cool enough that, like, I want to see those movies. Yeah, I want to see more of those.
And it shows you that Kurt Russell has been trained to be an absolutely ruthless killing machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, firing away through hostages,
yep.
to get at, you know, the enemy soldiers. But, I mean, it's also kind of showing that, you know, while these guys are, you know, human, they've never been shown any humanity.
Exactly. They've only been shown survival, pure survival, yes, and aggression. Yeah.
You know, this is completely, they're nurturing the dark side.
Right.
So, you know, we see that he's gone through several campaigns. They, you know, there's a computer readout, like I said, we said, they show that he's, you know, the recipient of the Pliskin Patch and the McCready Medal and all these other honors, and, you know, has confirmed kills in the hundreds and unconfirmed kills that could possibly put him in the thousands.
Right. As you see that, it's like, I wonder how they count that. Is it just by anecdote? Is it by assumption? It's like, well, there were like 10,000 people and now there's 7. So if we do the math, and just the unconfirmed kill part, is it just like, you know, he lobbed something in the direction of like a dozen people and then you don't see him anymore? So there's 12 unconfirmed kills, I guess. It's, you know.
Yeah, or he shot up a couple of people, but they didn't find the bodies on the battlefield, so they can't be confirmed they're dead. Yeah, I don't know how that works.
But it tells you what is important to this regime that they bother to track that. Because otherwise, it's just either you won the conflict or you didn't, right? Either you survived and you got your, you know, whatever across, or you didn't. But the number of kills, it's like a score sheet to them. It's extremely important.
Well, there's no other way to. There's really gauge no other their effectiveness, way to. Right, because I mean, like we mentioned, they only know how to follow orders.
Right.
They only know when they're pointed in a direction to go and kill, to go and kill. You know, there is no bravery, because they don't have it in their minds to choose to go and do something brave. They just do it. You know, it's not like, you know, a hero does something heroic because it's usually selfless.
Right. He had a decision, and he chose it. This is like, they don't even have a decision. Their only decision is whatever the order was.
They're almost robots.
Exactly.
Now we see that their commanding officer is played by Gary Busey. He has two lieutenants, one played by K.K. Dodds and the other played by Mark Bringelson. I think I'm saying his name right. The two lieutenants are almost superfluous to the movie.
Yeah.
Especially, it's like, you know, I don't even know why they decided they needed two when one could have, you know, done the job, but whatever. You know, they're the commanding officers of, you know, Sergeant Todd's unit. And now here comes Jason Isaacs, Colonel Meekum, and he's showing off his brand new soldiers. But these soldiers, like, he's saying to Gary Busey, your soldiers are trained from birth. Well, mine are prepared for combat before they're even born. They are genetically engineered to be the perfect soldier.
Right. Like, he doesn't explicitly say it, but you get the idea that they somehow figured out how to remove like any sense of mercy at the genetic level.
It seems like they also removed their ability to feel pain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty extreme. Like, they're not quite cyborgs, but they are even more robots than the generation that Kurt Russell's character came from. Jason Isaacs, by the way, he's getting my Whitbissell Award, because
Jason Isaacs is getting mine as well.
Yeah, he plays a extremely hateable character extremely well. I mean, he is smarmy, he's just a scumbag, but he does a great scumbag. I mean, how can I not
and recognize then not him? Only is he smarmy and scummy, we find out he's cowardly too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's nothing redeemable about this character, and he plays it perfectly.
Exactly. Yeah. It's less about, like, you've more or less seen that role before. You more or less can see where it's going to go, but he plays it to a T. He plays it perfectly.
So Gary Busey seems to take it almost personally. He's like, you know, saying, like, these soldiers have fought in campaign after campaign. We've seen the results. What are your soldiers? You know, you say they've been bred for this, but they have no combat experience. They've done nothing. There's no proof that they're superior to my soldiers. So, of course, the colonel says, well, pick your best man to go up against my best man. And they pick Sergeant Todd, and, you know, they show their ability with marksmanship, their endurance of, you know, running 5 miles. In fact, Sergeant Todd gets a 20-minute head start on the 5 mile run.
Actually, no, it's 15 miles.
Was it 15? It's right.
Yes, 15 miles, which has to be complete, which he gives. Yeah, you're right. 15 miles. And Sergeant Todd has already taken off on his jog, you know, 20 minutes later. And then they send off Kane, one of these new soldiers who
played by Jason Scott Lee.
Jason Scott Lee, who's fantastic, but he's more or less playing effectively a robot in this.
So, he looks super intimidating.
Yeah, exactly.
He knows how to have that look on his face, like,
for sure.
You don't. Not only do you not want to mess with this guy, you don't even want to be around this guy.
Well, he does a good, like, kind of dead eye, but also not quite. Like, it's yeah. There's a menace there, but it's also like,
he's not growling
right,
or mugging. He's just like...
It's even creepier, you know?
Yeah.
It's even creepier, the fact that you know there's nothing but pure menace there, but he's just like, there's nothing there at the same time. It's he's excellent at that. But, he gets a few lines, plenty of action, of course, but he gets a few lines. He gets to take off 20 minutes later, and he's told, you have 60 minutes, which means... he's going to sustain a 15-mile-an-hour run for an hour, which he does, and blows past Kurt Russell doing it.
Right, and even after Kurt Russell finishes the 15 miles, he's
sweating. Yeah,
he's sweating, and he's breathing. You know, not even as hard as I'd be breathing running down the hallway.
Sure.
But Jason Scott Lee's. Isn't even reacting.
Like, exactly.
He just strolled to the finish line.
Right.
And then, you know, it's like, well, you know, is he still ready for combat? And you're almost at this point, Gary Busey, like, what are you doing? You're just going to. So the colonel says, oh, you want me to go up against your soldier one-on-one? No, it's not fair. Put two more of your soldiers in. And they climb up these chains that are hanging there for, I assume, maybe physical
combat? I assume it's part of their exercise regimen.
But regardless, it's the one genetically engineered soldiers against the three veterans. And of course, it's really no contest.
Right.
The best Kurt Russell is able to do is to gouge out one of Jason Scott Lee's eyes.
Right. What doesn't help the case of the veterans as well is that they're probably a good 10 years, 15 years older than these new soldiers, these new, like, perfectly bred soldiers.
They're about half the size.
Right.
So, and in fact, you know, even, you know, after Jason Scott Lee did all this, the colonel calls him down and berates him.
For losing an eye, yeah.
For losing an eye. It's like, now all you can do is walk. You've got no depth perception. The best you can offer is to walk point and take the first bullet for somebody else. Meanwhile, you know, the three soldiers that he's defeated, one is dead. The other is kind of, you know, hanging up amongst the chains nearly. And Kurt Russell is unconscious, maybe presumed dead. And, you know, again, in this world of human life is completely disposable. He just gives the colonel gives the orders, all right, toss these bodies away and let's go on, because I don't want any paperwork involved in this either. And whether they thought Kurt Russell was dead or just didn't care, he gets tossed aboard.
He gets literally thrown in the trash.
Thrown in the trash, yeah. Into a garbage scow that takes them off to this planet called Arcadia, that is basically the galaxy's landfill.
Yeah, I think they just assumed he was dead and were covering up the evidence so that he could, like Jason Isaacs said, just pass it off as like a training accident, presumably saying he got blown up or something and, you know, mishandling a grenade or something, I guess.
And, but again, you almost wonder, like, who are they hiding it from? These soldiers right. have no families.
Right.
You know, and I can't believe that the higher ups care any more than they do.
Well, that's, yeah, like, that's where it gets a little strange because, again, they, you know, they showed earlier that of course, I guess it would have been 20 something years ago, but they have no problem shooting a child who's running behind. Right. Yeah, it's like, you'd think it would just be like, this is what we do. And, you know, it was interesting. It's also interesting to see the beginning of empathy on the part of Gary Busey, who he probably shouldn't be. But you suppose, like, you know, you just got to wonder, like, does that come with age regardless? You know, regardless of what you can try to breed out, because I guess we don't know, but I was under the assumption that Gary Busey was similar to these soldiers at one point, you know, or at least grew up in the same sort of concept. Like maybe he's even a previous generation, presumably, than Kurt Russell's group. But you can see humanity in him. Not much, yes, but it's there.
He's also, you know, he's been their commanding officer through dozens of military campaigns for years. So I'm sure a certain attachment grows. I mean, I know when I play some stupid video game where I'm commanding armies against other armies and I have certain units that are, you know, I've had for longer in the campaign than others, there's a certain attachment that comes, you know, like, these are my best troops. You become attached, kind of.
It was exactly that thought process, by the way, that germinated Dungeons and Dragons as we know it. It went from wargaming to like, oh, I really like these things. You know, these, for whatever reason, these units have made it so long. I want to do more with that. And it kind of grew into D&D.
Yeah, they're your best troops. So you want to put them in the front lines, but you also don't want to throw them away either.
Right.
So anyways, Kurt Russell is found by a community that had crash landed on Arcadia 12 years ago and were never able to repair their ship. And they, you know, you find out that they tried flagging down, you know, the garbage ships as they, you know, dropped off trash, but they realize they're obviously robotically piloted, you know,
right, computer they're just piloted. Drones, basically.
They don't have crews, so they've had to just make their do here on the planet and survive as best they can. We should mention that, like, while Kurt Russell is the star and is in almost every scene of this movie, he probably has about...
Oh, he barely speaks, yeah.
Yeah, I think somebody counted that he has a total of 100... He speaks a total of 107 words.
That's more than I would have thought. I would have thought, like, maybe half that.
Yeah. But, you know, they find him. They know he's a soldier. You know, they take him in, they heal his wounds. You know, there are, of course, people in the community that are uncomfortable with the soldier being there. And we've got Sean Pertwee and Connie Nielsen, a married couple who have a young boy. They're the ones that have really taken him in and, you know, treated him and are trying to get him into society. But Kurt Russell, his character doesn't know what to do. This is so beyond any experience he's ever had.
Right, because no one's giving him orders to do things. Like, right, he has to think for himself.
Telling him what to do and, yeah, you know, drilling or exercising or, you know, right, whatever. They're treating him with a kindness that he doesn't understand either.
Right, right. Like, he's now able to think for himself, and unfortunately for him, it means he's starting to reflect on all the stuff that he's done over the last 30-odd years.
Well, the first part comes when, you know, he's finally able to get out of bed, and he's kind of helping them out on, you know, doing small tasks because he's powerful and strong from all his training, so he can help, you know, do things that, you know, the others have struggled a little bit more with. And one night at dinner, while they're all in the dining hall, one of the community members just kind of gets up and is like, look, what are you doing here, soldier? Why are you here? And the soldier, you know, he stands up to answer. And, of course, everybody's on edge. It's like, oh, and he just says, I was replaced by another soldier, sir.
Yeah, he calls everybody sir.
And Michael Chiklis, who's also great in this, is one of the more sympathetic, you know, community members who's, you know, even, come on, guy, let the man eat. You know, what difference does he hear? You know, he's like us now. He's one of us. He has been abandoned on this planet.
Right. He's not going anywhere. We're all stuck here. So he's stuck here, too.
And then one day while they're out gardening, we find out this planet has these tiny little really green snakes. And they're super poisonous. And Connie Nielsen's son was bitten by one and hasn't been able to speak since. And in fact, he barely survived the bite. And so you know there's that threat out there. And another threat is these huge windstorms that come up out of almost nowhere and can literally blow a man across the planet. They even have like these cement blocks around where they're working, so they can instantly clip themselves to these cement blocks, helping them be held down and not blown away.
Reminds me a little of The Thing.
Yes. And while this is, you know, while one of these storms hits, Michael Chiklis' character is too far away and he starts getting picked up by the wind, but he's holding on to a rope that the others are holding on to, but they just can't seem to get him. And Kurt Russell on his own just starts reeling this guy in, who is not only being blown away, being blown into this giant thresher for whatever reason.
Yes.
Happens to be there, yes, just to make the situation even more deadly.
Right.
But, you know, he saves Michael Chiklis's life, and Michael Chiklis is, you know, elated and is like, you know, wants to thank him. But again, the soldier has no idea, like, how to react to any of this. Like, you know, why is this guy coming up to me, wanting to touch me, wanting to shake my... What is this all about?
Right. To him, it's just, for all he knows, it's an act of aggression. Because the only other people he has seen is either other soldiers or people trying to kill him.
And as far as he's concerned, he did what you're supposed to do. You saved your fellow soldier.
Right.
And one later on, like while they're celebrating, I would assume Christmas Eve, there, you know, he's in, I guess they do kind of have a gym. He's punching this hanging like a
muffler
metal
or something.
Yeah, a hot water heater or something. He's practicing on that when Michael Chick is like, hey, I got him this scarf. You know, he saved my life and everything. I'm going to go give it to him. And you see, while, you know, Kurt Russell is doing all this punching, he's kind of having like what would be PTSD if even he as a soldier understood what PTSD was.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's having all these flashbacks. It's all these aggression. And it's unfortunate that this is the time Michael Chiklis decides to go up to him again and put a hand on his shoulder, because he reacts violently and almost kills Michael Chiklis, strangling him.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, he's been literally taught violence as the solution to every single problem he has. And more importantly, to never, ever think for himself, which unfortunately for him, or perhaps fortunately, depending on how you look at it, is now what he's stuck doing. You know, before his head would just be filled with orders and aggression and missions and whatever. Now it's like he actually has time to reflect. So I wonder what goes on in his mind with really without any frame of reference.
You know? Well, that's the thing is, and then he can tell by the way everybody's reacting, he's done something wrong and this isn't what he should be doing, but he still can't really process it.
Right.
And even Michael Chiklis seems to be like, you know, as scared as he was, he even still kind of understands that, you know, this isn't, you know, it's
not personal.
Almost my bad.
Yeah. It's not personal. Yeah.
No.
He's clearly troubled, you know. He just got abandoned on a trash planet. Like he's got stuff going on. Yeah, Michael Chiklis takes it quite well.
And Connie Nielsen and Sean Pertwee are still standing up for him because he's been, you know, helpful. He's been, you know, as friendly as he can possibly be. You know, they understand. You know, I don't know whether the people of this society know what the soldiers go through.
Right. Well, that's the thing. We don't really know. Exactly where they're from and how long they've been away from, I assume, Earth is where it started.
No. All we know is that they have been on, the community's been on this planet for 12 years.
Yeah.
Right. So, unfortunately, it all comes down to one night while they're in Sean Pertree and Connie Nielsen are in bed, and their son Nathan is wandering around. He's almost bitten by a snake again, but Sergeant Todd pulls the snake away, keeps it from biting him. But instead of killing it instantly, he kind of tosses it back at the kid, showing the kid how to kill it.
Right.
He wants to show the kid how to survive out in that world.
Right, like he's showing him to beat it with his boot. He gave him his boot to beat the snake to death with, but the kid is either too afraid or not fully understanding it or what.
Well, and considering, as we know, the kid almost died from being bitten by one of these.
He's probably terrified, yeah.
Perfectly understandable why he'd be terrified.
Exactly.
I don't know whether Sean Pertree and Carly Nielsen misunderstand or just don't approve. But now they've decided, like, okay, you know what? This guy, no, he is too dangerous to live among us.
He
needs to be exiled.
I think it might be a combination of the two. I just thought it was strange that that particular thing was the tipping point. I think they could have done something else that would have made it a little bit more understandable. I just thought that particular one was strange.
I think it's fitting that obviously, like, Connie Nielsen and Sean Pertree wanted to do everything they could for him, but the moment they put their son in danger, you know, now that was the last straw. I think that's perfectly understandable.
I guess. I guess they could see, like, you know, the fact that he didn't kill it and was trying to get their son to do it. Yeah, that is putting him in danger. All right.
So at this point, Soldier is exiled from the community, and it's heartbreaking for him, particularly because these people taught him, whether they knew it or not, they taught him how to feel and what it was like to be part of a community, and then they took that away from him and cast him out.
Right, what it was like to live a life without just pure survival orders and killing.
You know? They taught him feelings, and then they hurt those feelings.
Right, but to their credit, they did at least explicitly state, I mean, while they didn't exactly exile him, they were basically like, you can't stay here, but you can come back to us if you need help, and we'll give you stuff to help survive, and if you need stuff, you can come talk to us again. Like, they were willing to still associate with him, which is like, you can't be here. You're too dangerous. Which I thought was at least reasonable, you know? They didn't full-on exile him, like, you know, they didn't scream at him, or anything like that. It was just like, look, you're too dangerous to be here. You got to go. But, you know, you're still welcome here to, like, converse and be around. We just don't really trust you.
While all that's going on, we cut back to Colonel Meekum and, you know, his squad of genetically engineered soldiers and the older generation soldiers who are now basically used as for manual labor. They're no longer considered soldiers. They are going to be going on a mission to land on planets, put up beacons and other early warning systems, because we don't know who they're at war with, but there does seem to be a state of perpetual war.
Right.
Especially going back to the montage.
The montage, earlier. Right. The montage implies exactly that they're in some sort of state of perpetual war, or at least conflict expanding. Not really sure. Presumably, though, there's probably more than a few, like, rebel factions against whatever this government is called.
Well, again, we don't even know if there's a United Earth government.
Right.
But they're going to be going out to uninhabited planets to put out these beacons and then do some, you know, training maneuvers for the new soldiers to gather experience. And, you know, Gary Busey even points out, well, and the planets are supposed to be uninhabited, but what if they are? And Colonel Meekum just blatantly puts it, well, they're not supposed to be there, so if they are there, they will be hostiles, and we'll have to eliminate them. It'll be perfect training for the new generations of soldiers.
He's always looking at the bright side, Meekum. I respect that.
Yes. We also, like, while all that's going on, you know, the lieutenant goes down to, you know, even brief Todd's old unit, and they're like, you know, you're going to be planting the beacons and setting them up and making sure they're operational. And, you know, the guy who was Todd's second in command, will we be issued weapons? They're like, no, weapons are for soldiers. You're not a soldier anymore. And then the guy salutes her and says, she's like, you don't even have to salute anymore. You're no longer a soldier. And again, it's like, you know, these guys like, well, yeah, this is what we're meant to be.
What else are we going to do? Yeah.
You know, you're telling me I'm obsolete, but, well, can I be trained for something else?
Right.
No.
I'm kind of surprised they weren't just shot in the head like that kid, you know, in the beginning. I'm surprised they're even still there.
That is, you know, it is kind of, you know, questionable, but I guess they decided, you know, they need support troops, or maybe even if we come to a situation, they can go out there and block bullets for the genetically engineered soldiers too.
Right.
So the soldiers, of course, one of the planets that they're planning to do the maneuvers on is, of course, Arcadia, where, you know, this community has been stranded. So one night after the exile, Sean Pertree and Connie Nielsen are in bed together sleeping when they're awakened by one of the snakes has gotten into their bed. And just as it's about to bite one of them, their son grabs it, throws it onto the floor, and kills it with his boot, just as Sergeant Todd had shown him. And this is when they both realize he did save our boy's life. He has shown our son how to survive. We were completely wrong. We shouldn't have exiled him.
Right.
And Sean Pertree goes out to locate Sergeant Todd,
right,
to bring him back to the community.
Right. You get the idea that it's just like, oh, yeah, you know what? Someone like him could be extremely beneficial to us because none of us really know how to fight. Not that they needed to. I mean, they're abandoned on a trash planet. But, you know, the survival skills that he has, maybe they are useful. You know, maybe they could work it out.
And he was, you know, ultimately looking out for our son.
Exactly.
Maybe
he wasn't
see it initially. But, you know, we're not always going to be there to look out for him. So he needs to know how to look out for himself. So Pertree goes out searching for Sergeant Todd. And, you know, it doesn't take him long to find him because there's not too many places he could go anyways.
Yeah, he didn't go very far.
And he tries to, you know.
Nor did they ask him to either. Like, that's the other thing. It was just, you can't be here.
Yeah, we should have explained better that the community is basically in this fortified, you know, building all together. You know, it's not like they got little houses. It's just junk planet where they've cobbled together, you know, a place to live in. So he finds Sergeant Todd, and as he's welcoming him back, this is at the exact point where Colonel Meekum and the soldiers land on their planet to conduct their maneuvers. And they come out, you know, as foot soldiers and in these two of these crawlers that are basically giant tank slash personnel carriers, heavily armored, heavily armed personnel carriers that, you know, come out on the planet.
Yeah, evocative of the ones and aliens, but bigger, I would say.
Yeah. Todd immediately recognizes the danger of what's going on and tells Pertree to follow him and stay as close as possible. And as they're running back to the village, they're spotted and fired upon. Pertree takes a fatal wound to the leg. Sergeant Todd is able to get away with him, you know, pick him up, carry him to cover. And the soldiers believe they've been eliminated in the barrage. And that's when they also pick up that there's life signs on the planet. And Colonel Meekum's like, well, they're trespassing, so it's our job to blast them off the planet. So as Todd is treating Pertree's wound, he's like, it's no good. I've lost too much blood. I'm not going to make it. He realizes that these other soldiers are going to go wipe out the community, and he implores Todd to go save whoever he can, especially his son Nathan, you know, among them. And so Todd, you know, heads off, you know, Pertree dies. Todd heads off to, you know, take on the soldiers. And the soldiers figure they only need 3 foot soldiers to go in to take out this community, which is correct, because, well, they also bombarded the village as well.
Yeah. But,
you know, these soldiers go in and just start slaughtering everybody in sight. you know, machine guns, rocket launchers, flamethrowers. Tart arrives in time to take the three of them out and, you know, save a good chunk of the survivors. And this is where you get, you know, this is the, this, it was used for the trailer scene because it's the perfect scene to sum up the movie. Whereas after he's killed the three soldiers, you know, Connie Nielsen comes out to question him, like, well, who are they? He goes, they're soldiers, ma'am, like me. Well, will they be? Yes, they will be back. How many more? 17, ma'am. Well, 17, sir. Now, put a note in that, because there's definitely more than 17 soldiers he goes out to kill in the next scene.
Yeah, it's an oddly specific number. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's just, it was a squad of 20. He took out three, so there must be 17 more. Yeah. But yeah, that is, it turns out, but he's, you know, he's doing almost like the famous action quote of the, you know, preparing the weapons, loading guns. You know, and she's like, well, what are you going to do? I'm going to kill them all, sir. And cut to the badass picking up the weapons, walking out through the smoky and off to combat. And what follows is basically, you know, those famous scenes from First Blood and First Blood Part 2 of one man taking out the army one by one by one, sometimes in groups, of leading them into traps, knifing them, shooting them, blowing them up. It's top-notch 80s action from the late 90s.
All richly deserved too, because you know, one of the first things the soldiers do when they come across like the trash planet colony or whatever you want to call it, when this woman comes out to, like, you know, parlay, they shoot her with a rocket.
Yeah, completely freaking rocket. Unarmed.
Completely unarmed woman. Not like dozens of them, mind you. Not even behind anything. She just walks out like into the clearing and gets nailed with a rocket.
Not acting hostile or in any way. Yeah.
A rocket. You figure just the cost alone would have made that crazy, but I guess it's training exercise, you know, they have the equipment.
Well, and as the communiques come back from the genetically enhanced soldiers to Colonel Meekum and the commanding officers, they start wondering what the heck's going on out there. And, you know, Meekum and Gary Busey is actually the one that comes up with the idea. It's like, well, just use the artillery to bombard the whole section, you know, almost like Ellen Ripley's take off and nuke the site for Mormont. It's the only way to be sure. So, I mean, there's really no better way to describe it than, you know, see the movie and watch the carnage.
Right, because it'd be really hard to explain the next, you know, fantastic 20, 30 minutes or so.
It comes down to, of course, you know, mano-a-mano combat between, you know, Sergeant Todd and
Kane
again to, you know, take each other on. And of course, Kane is bigger, stronger, and faster. But the difference here is Kane isn't fighting for anything.
Right.
He's fighting because he's been ordered to fight. And just as Sergeant Todd was for most of his life, but now Sergeant Todd actually has something to fight for.
Right.
Something to protect.
Right. That, and you get the idea that, you know, Kane and his other men, like, they're not trained to think beyond whatever their orders are. Like, I don't know how far they're even allowed to think outside the box, as it were.
They know how to fight and kill, but they don't know how to improvise,
right,
which is something else Sergeant Todd has learned and has gained as an experience.
And I think also what Gary Busey was trying to say at the beginning when he was comparing his soldiers versus the new ones, but he didn't really quite. I mean, he does. He mentions, like, you know, the combat experience and all that. So I take that back. Actually, he did. He tried to mention the combat experience and all that. But Meekum is just like, he's just looking at numbers.
So, of course, when the command squad back at the ship realize they've lost contact with all their soldiers, they come up with the, you know, scorched earth policy that they have a planet killer bomb on board, and they're going to have the old generation soldiers bring that out, set it up, and basically destroy the planet to claim victory.
Right.
After the, you know, lost all their soldiers.
Now, the thing, not only does this thing, this, like, you know, training exercise, and whatever the ship is attached to it, have a planet killer bomb, apparently they have many of them. Because yes. Gary Busey mentions they have, like, something like 18 or something of them.
It might just be standard issue on these military ships.
Yeah, no, as I'm saying, it just gives you the idea of how far this has gone. You know, they're willing to just blow up multiple planets.
So now that, you know, Todd has defeated all the soldiers, he has gathered up the rest of the surviving members of the colonists, and they're going to try to go take the ship because, you know, it's not even about defeating the enemy at this point. It's like, if we can get that ship, we can finally get off this planet, which is even more important now because the colony they built for themselves to help them survive has been destroyed.
Right.
You know, they've lost dozens of members of their community, and their world has been destroyed.
Well, plus, on the off chance they survive this whole battle and defeat, you know, Meekum's forces and even kill Meekum, there's just going to be more. Like, the jig is up. They're now, yeah. You know, it's known that they're there. So, like, if, you know, you know that whatever government sent them in the first place, it's just going to be more, and it's going to be that much worse if they're not just nuked outright.
Right. It'll be basically a revenge.
Right. They don't have a choice but to get out of there and find some new place to hide.
So the old generation soldiers, Todd's old squad, come out and they set up the bomb and get it ready, to set the timer on it, just as Sergeant Todd shows up. And they, of course, recognize him. And they're obviously happy to see them if they knew the emotion of happiness again, right. Because they don't know. And obviously they're ready to follow Todd's orders. Because while they're out there, you know, Colonel Meacham is now ordering Gary Busey, the ship, to take off. And Gary Busey's like, my men aren't back yet. They're still out there. It's like, it doesn't matter. Take off. And finally, Gary Busey has had enough of Colonel Meacham. He gets up to put him in his place, but Meacham shoots Gary Busey dead, which is almost Gary Busey's punishment for finally becoming human.
Right.
You know. Standing up for his men.
Right, showing weakness.
And while he had questioned Colonel Meekum's orders and his entire thought of genocide, he didn't stop it.
Right. This is the first time he stood up to actually do something about it. Mostly it was just like comments, but he did it anyway.
And now Meekum is holding the two lieutenants at gunpoint, telling them to take off, which they are just about ready to do when they hear the sound of marching footsteps coming up behind them. And the older generation soldiers come in, they grab all three of them and start dragging them off the ship. And Colonel Meekum is like yelling, like, "You're disobeying orders. What are you doing? Stop." A door opens and there stands Kurt Russell in all his badass glory, and Colonel Meacham urinates himself.
Yes.
The three of them are thrown off the ship. Todd and his squad reunited, get all the rest of the colonists on board, and they take off. Meacham and the two lieutenants go running to disable the planet killer bomb. Unfortunately, Meekum screws up the deactivation code and it goes off, and the three of them are killed along with the planet.
It's almost poetic that his final act of, you know, violent impatience is what does him in.
Yes.
Because if he had just calmed down, they might have got it right.
I do question, you know, while the two lieutenants, you know, were basically, you know, basically this was the soldiers basically announcing that, yeah, we're done with our military service with you and we're done with you officers. And I'm not sure their punishment fits their, you know, crime.
Well, we don't know their history, really.
Definitely had it coming.
Yeah.
Well, but it also seemed like Meekum and, well, the two lieutenants were more sympathetic to the old soldiers and Gary Busey. But also, if you think about it, the soldiers didn't kill them. They tossed them off the ship.
Right. Right, to deal with their own problem that they just started.
Yeah, and they knew how to disconnect. I don't think the soldiers intended for them to die just as much as to be left stranded on the planet.
Yeah, I think it crossed their mind the possibility, but like you're saying, like they left them with all of the ability to survive. They know how to disable the bomb, so if they do, great. If they don't, then well.
It was really more about we're taking your ship,
right?
And we're actually doing, you know, we're going to take these civilians to safety. So they plot a course to a distant star system, obviously, you know, maybe some, you know, a planet they know he knows they can survive on, but obviously far and remote enough that they're not going to be bothered by anybody. You know, the military isn't going to come looking for them or anything like that. And our final shot is, you know, Kurt Russell holding the kid, who really seemed to have imprinted on Kurt Russell as his new dad before even Connie Nielsen has decided, yes, he's right, new daddy. But, you know, it's Hollywood. It's meant to be kind of simplistic, but it's they're looking off into space towards the future.
I think like
towards a new life.
I mean, yeah, there's still like the framing of the 80s sort of in there with that, which I think in a good way. It's almost like the last gasp of the 80s action hero.
Yes. I mean, again,
in 1998.
This movie doesn't have anything new to say. Maybe it had something new to say when the script was originally written.
Right.
But by the time it was come out, it is loaded with action movie and sci-fi cliches, but it uses them perfectly.
Right. Right. Nothing wrong with a trope if you do it right.
No. And this is a wildly entertaining movie that not only do they not make anymore now, they really didn't make them in 98 when they made this one. This really was a refuge of the 80s.
It really was. Flashback almost.
The closest you can get to something like this now is something that would be made direct for a streaming service at best.
Right.
But it is so, first of all, it's Kurt Russell, so what else do you need? It's Kurt Russell in an action role. And it is just, it's, everything that is done exceedingly well. And this is kind of, you know, I think this is probably Paul W.S. Anderson's second best movie. I think his best is Event Horizon.
Oh, he did Event Horizon?
Yes,
I didn't realize that. I agree that Event Horizon is amazing.
I mean, he's most famous for the Resident Evil films, but he's the kind of director that we sorely need.
Yes,
especially
we need movies
today.
Like this. Still, yeah,
we need more movies like this. You know, this middle tier, you know, modestly budgeted action adventure film that just, you know, tries to entertain. It's not, you know, it's not world ending. It's not over the top. It's not completely bombarding you with explosions and gunfire. And while I do enjoy those movies, once everything is epic, nothing is epic.
Right.
This is a perfectly entertaining sci-fi action film. It's middle of the road, but it's just like, it's like your favorite fast food burger.
Exactly.
You've had it a dozen times, but it's always good. You know, it's never, you know, it's not like you're going out to a really nice meal, or even like, you know, some of those restaurants that make really amazing burgers, but you know what you're getting, and it's comforting, and it fills that spot. You know, it hits the spot.
Exactly. It's the Egg McMuffin and hash brown. It's everything I want.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so much fun. I remember my first time hearing about this movie was in the back of, I think it was a magazine called Sci-Fi Invasion. It was whatever the Sci-Fi Channel's official science fiction magazine was.
Okay.
And at the end of all the issues, they always had a list of upcoming sci-fi movies that were planned to be in production. And for several issues, they kept announcing Soldier, a futuristic sci-fi action movie starring Kurt Russell. And that was all that it took for me to get excited.
Absolutely.
But the movie, like we said, the movie was in production for a good long time, and I started to doubt it was going to happen, feeling that the movie was had gone into production hell and was, you know, perpetually. And I think if it wasn't for Paul W.S. Anderson deciding to do it, it probably wouldn't have gotten made. Because I know one of the things they delayed production on was because Kurt Russell wanted to get into really good shape. So they're like, all right, we'll give you time to do that while we do pre-production.
He's in fantastic shape.
Yes.
In this, yeah. It paid and off.
Really? Okay, he was in Dark Blue, and I think you did Breakdown after this.
Was it after? I thought Breakdown was earlier.
Breakdown may have been before. But this is kind of Russell's last big action adventure movie that he stars in, because of course he was in a couple of the Fast and the Furious movies, but he isn't really so much the star of that. You know what?
No, you're right. Breakdown was the year before. Sorry.
3,000 Miles to Graceland.
Oh yes.
Which wasn't a hit, but it is a fun movie.
It's a really fun movie. Yeah.
You know, but that's, you know, if Kurt Russell's in it, I'm checking it out
for sure. No question.
You know, and this is definitely not in my top 5 Kurt Russell movies, but in my top 10.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if you haven't seen this movie, check it out. It's out there to see. It's a lot of fun. If you didn't know any better, I'm sure if you were watching it for the first time now, you would assume it was made in the 80s and not the late 90s, but it doesn't matter. This would have been a canon film.
Oh, for sure.
I'm surprised Cannon didn't get this one made in the mid-80s. They probably would have had it starring Chuck Norris, but it still would have been pretty awesome.
That would have been fun to see a Cannon version of this, yeah.
Anything else you want to say specifically about Soldier?
Only that it's maybe the only movie that contains a Todd I can be proud of.
What about the other Kurt Russell movie, The Fox and the Hound?
Yes. Well, there you go. The only other movie then with Todd that I can be proud of. Both Kurt Russell. So thank you, Kurt, for that.
Thank you, Kurt, for everything. And happy birthday.
And happy birthday, of course. Yes.
All right. So why don't we move on into our exploitative title of this movie?
So I have Future War, Massacre on the Trash Planet.
You are very close to mine. Mine is Space Massacre, Last Stand at Arcadia.
Oh, right on. Yeah, we were both basically along the same lines, yeah.
All right, so recommendations.
Recommendations? I guess I would go with Starship Troopers. I mean, that's almost like a sister idea to this movie, you know, similar. As we discussed, you could say that Starship Troopers, you know, handling is somewhat softer, but it's that same sort of vibe.
I guarantee you the novel was an inspiration for this movie.
Yes. That's what I get from it. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, like we said, this is sort of a throwback. So really, I mean, fire up any of the Stallone or Schwarzenegger movies of the time, and you know, you'll have a great time. You probably are already well aware of them, so you can kind of just pick any of them.
I would say, you know, more specifically in tone with this would be Universal Soldier.
Oh yeah, Universal Soldier. You know, I forgot about that.
A lot of similarities to that. You know, another great action movie. You know, Jean-Claude Van Damme versus Dolph Lundgren.
Check that out if you haven't seen Universal Soldier. It's kind of a forgotten movie. I don't know how much of that had to do with the not great sequels. Although I guess the third one was all right. The second one was just so bad. Maybe worth seeing just in that respect because it's pretty bad. But the first one's a damn good movie.
The first two sequels were like Showtime produced movies starring somebody else. And then there was the first official sequel, Universal Soldier: The Return, with Bill Goldberg is one of the evil Universal soldiers.
That's so bad.
You know, the movie, it's bad, but it's
worth seeing. Yeah, it's worth seeing. Yes. You know, whatever you get from it is whatever you get from it. Like, I don't regret seeing it just because, you know, it was an experience, but it's not a very good one.
Then there were two more Universal Soldier movies with Jean-Claude Van Damme returning, as well as Dolph Lundgren returning. In fact, the last Universal Soldier they made was Scott Adkins was the hero, and Jean-Claude Van Damme had basically developed into a bad guy who wanted to, you know, the Universal Soldiers to take over the world.
I don't think I've seen that one.
It's entertaining, and it's got some really great action, but it is kind of like, did we want to see our hero, played by Jean-Claude Van Damme, become the bad guy?
Yeah.
So it's kind of disappointing in that way. That kind of takes some of the fun away, but it is a well-made action movie, and Scott Adkins is a really good action star. So it's, you got to take it one way. Like, if you don't want to see Jean-Claude, if you don't want to see the hero character, you know, become the bad guy, I would say don't see it. But otherwise, it's an entertaining movie. All right. Anything else? You ready to move on to Magnificent 7 Degrees, where we connect this movie to my favorite movie, The Magnificent Seven?
Yes, I have one.
All right.
So we have Gary Busey was also in Silver Bullet with Terry O'Quinn, who was in Space Camp with Tom Skerritt, who was in Fighting Back with Yaphet Kotto, who was in Live and Let Die with Lois Maxwell, who was Miss Moneypenny, right? Who was also in You Only Live Twice with Donald Pleasence, who was in The Great Escape with Steve McQueen and Charles Bronson.
Okay. I also started with Gary Busey. Gary Busey was in The Magnificent Seven Ride, third sequel to Magnificent Seven.
I didn't know that.
And so if you don't connect to the sequel, well, the star of Magnificent Seven Ride was Lee Van Cleef, who was in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly with Eli Wallach.
Yes.
Who was in The Magnificent Seven. So there's two ways to connect it to Gary Busey. He's got a small role in The Magnificent Seven Ride, where he's one of three men who kidnap and murder Lee Van Cleef's wife, which sets off the events of The Magnificent Seven Ride.
I had no idea he was in that. I know I've seen the movie, but I don't think I would have recognized him at the time or realized, because it's been a long
time. Oh, no, you can
time.
Tell it's him.
Yeah.
You can straight up tell it's him. All right, so anything else?
No, that's all I got, except yet again, thank you, Kurt Russell, and happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. Pat ourselves on the back because I've been able to hit the record button for 150 times.
Yes.
So, you know, champions on that. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, and X, all at Movie Matt Sirois, one word, MovieMattSirois. And Letterboxd is really a great place to follow us under that as well. You know, you can get an idea of what the movie's going to be and what we're watching, and, well, what I'm watching and rating other movies as. Like, I just did a review for the 1988 creature feature Slugs, which Todd and I watched for the first time the other night.
Oh, man.
And it was fun, and it was surprisingly gory.
Yeah. Yeah, like that's I mean, it's about where I draw the line for gore. I will say that the effects were extremely good, and you know, if it's your kind of movie, then definitely seek this movie out. Like, I did enjoy it, but man, is it's something.
Yeah. But you can see that in other reviews we've done on Letterboxd. With that, we thank you for listening and hope to have you back next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay gold, people.